much, Errol, and let me again publicly thank those responsible for inviting me to be here, for giving me not only the privilege, and that would have been sufficient, to meet with so many like-minded men concerned about the work of the gospel in these days, but also the added honor of speaking at two of these sessions. In the initial publicity, our title for this session was, I think, Justification by Faith and Mobilizing the Church for Evangelism, and only an author could have given a session that length of title. And I did explain to Errol by correspondence that he could miss out the Justification by Faith bit in the title, and that that was not in any way going to be a part of the session, and I think you would not expect it to be, and that statement won't be misunderstood. So we're working within the framework of mobilizing the church for evangelism. The story is told of an unmarried postgraduate sociological student who prepared a dazzling lecture entitled 10 Rules for Bringing Up Children. It was a brilliant lecture, and he gave it on many occasions and in many places. He later got married, and after the birth of their first child, he made some significant changes to the lecture and entitled it 10 Suggestions for Bringing Up Children. They later had a second child, and the lecture was now amended to Some Thoughts on Bringing Up Children. And after the birth of their third child, he scrapped the lecture altogether. I've been in full-time evangelistic ministry since 1962, and I've had the opportunity of preaching in a multitude of places and in many different circumstances, but I sometimes feel that what some people may perceive to be a qualification for speaking to this subject is in fact as much a disqualification. And I feel with all my heart, very much akin to James S. Stewart in Heralds of God, speaking on the subject of preaching, when he says this: even if Providence should spare you to this work for 50 years, your thought will be, as the gloaming closes in around you, if only I could start all over again now. Let me just bring you to Scripture and read a few verses. We will not expound them, but seek to be as practical as I can throughout the session. But Acts chapter 8 and verse 1. Acts chapter 8, verses 1 to 4. On that day, a great persecution broke out against the church at Jerusalem, and all except the apostles were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria. Godly men buried Stephen and mourned deeply for him. But Saul began to destroy the church. Going from house to house, he dragged off men and women and put them in prison. Those who had been scattered preached the word wherever they went. Let me begin by mentioning two things that I'm not going to do. And the first is to speak on the subject of mobilizing the church at large for evangelism. I'm not going to address the need of mobilizing, if such a thing could be done, the church on an international or on a national scale. There may be those today who feel that they have a, quote, prophetic, unquote, word to say to the world church in that kind of situation, but whoever they may be, I'm not among them. Secondly, I'm not going to give a nuts and bolts guaranteed way of mobilizing the local church on a continuous basis. I've never held office in a local church beyond that of being a youth leader and a Bible class leader. I have never held pastoral office in a church, and although I do not claim to have the gift of prophecy, I don't believe I ever will, for the simple reason that I don't have those particular gifts. I have an unbounded, and I mean that, an unbounded admiration, not an envy, a genuine admiration for those who have the gift of the pastor and teacher within a local church situation. I recall being at an evangelist conference, a very small gathering, about 10 of us, a number of years ago, and hearing Tom Butler, that fine, godly Methodist, evangelist from the Sheffield area, saying in prayer in the course of that conference. We were just huddled together in prayer one day, and he used this phrase, "Lord, help us to glow in the other man's gifts." And I thought for an evangelist to pray that in a small group of evangelists was really quite something. And I do want you to know that I glow in the gifts that God has given to you. I don't envy you, but I rejoice in what God has done in you, through you, and for you, knowing that because he's not gifted me in that way, that I cannot do the same work. So let me narrow it to this, and trump Errol by giving you a longer title, if you will, and not giving you time to take it down. I will give you some reflections and suggestions on local church evangelism that are loosely based on my experience of special evangelistic efforts. I want to begin with something potentially depressing, and that is that the New Testament says almost nothing on the subject. That seems to me what I discover. Whereas today our skies and roads are jammed with Christians, evangelists, pastors, lay leaders and others shuttling from one conference and convention and seminar after another, excluding this one, of course, which is entirely necessary, and as we all know, is held in the capital of the world, here in Liverpool, as we've been informed by our wholly unbiased chairman this morning. There's obviously no one here from Crookfield. They're going to one seminar after another aimed at challenging and mobilizing and instructing the church in the work of evangelism. But when we come to the New Testament, we discover almost nothing of that going on. I would say we discover nothing of that going on. We have the Great Commission in Matthew 28. We have the Mark 16 passage about going into all the world. We have Acts 1. On being witnesses to an ever widening circle of responsibility, but I'm asking, even on my feet, what else is there? I suggest that we can comb the 21 epistles and find scarcely a word. 2 Timothy 4, instructions to Timothy to do the work of the evangelist. We'll comment on that briefly in a moment. No details are given. 1 Peter 3, about being ready to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give a reason for the hope that you have. Jude 23, about snatching people from the fire. And virtually nothing else. Now, why is there such a dearth of that which we consider important enough to give two whole sessions to it at this conference? I want to make the suggestion that the reason for the dearth is that evangelism in the New Testament was what a friend of mine used to call the natural outcome of a spiritual income. And it seems to me that we have it in microcosm here in Acts 8. And notice that in verse 1, the great persecution broke out against the church at Jerusalem, and all except the apostles were scattered abroad. The apostles weren't. They stayed there. And the others, the hoi polloi, were scattered abroad. And then in verse 4, those who had been scattered preached the word wherever they went. Not the professionals, not the leaders. I'm not suggesting that they weren't busy preaching the gospel where they were, but these were what we now call the laymen. And wherever they went, they preached the gospel. You just had to add a Christian to the situation, and you could guarantee that the gospel was going to be preached. I'll refer to that passage again, but let me give you this comment by Albert Barnes. It is not said that they set themselves up for public teachers, or that they administered baptism, or that they founded churches, but they proclaimed everywhere the news that a Savior had come. Their hearts were full of it. And we dare not miss that significance. They weren't graduates from college. They weren't delegates from conferences. They weren't students from seminars. Instead, they had come into vibrant touch with the gospel, and their hearts were full of it. And they were what we would call the ordinary church members in the pew. When the church spent so much time informing and instructing and directing its membership on the need and the urgency and the relevance and the importance, and on patterns of evangelism, there is something seriously wrong. And what is wrong, essentially, is this. Their hearts are not full of it. And if their hearts are not full of it, filling their heads with technical information about it will not solve the problem. Michael Green has rightly said, there's not enough fire in their belly. And we may turn to that later. Perhaps we're guilty, especially in aspiringly middle-class evangelicalism, and much of it is, of being too bookish and cerebral and technical. We have files instead of fire. I'm sure that all of you who are pastors have many members, not as many as you would like, because every pastor is a perfectionist, I think. You have many members with a good grasp of doctrine, fine moral standards, set a good example in society. But how many members do you have in your church who have what used to be called a passion for souls? We don't use the phrase anymore, or rarely. It's a rather old-fashioned term. It's a rather crude and distasteful term, to have a passion for souls. We have people with a passion for books. And it is a tragedy if we have replaced the passion for souls with a passion for books. And to say that in this conference is a highly dangerous thing. Everywhere I look, there's a publisher looking for an author. And I find it distressing that one publisher should look out over me and say, we're looking for an author. But still, we'll go on. How does your average church member shape up to these words by Richard Baxter? If you have the hearts of Christians and of men, let them yearn towards your poor, ignorant, ungodly neighbours. Alas, there is but a step between them and death and hell. Have you hearts of rock that you cannot pity men in such a case as this? If you believe not the word of God and the dangers of sinners, why are you Christians yourselves? And if you do believe it, why do you not bestir yourselves to the saving of others, to the helping of others? Do you not care who is damned as long as you are saved? Now, how do your church members match up to that? I suggest that Baxter's words are as relevant now as when they were first spoken. I'm just plucking a figure out of the air here. Let me make the suggestion that 75% of your church membership have not invited 10 people into your church to hear the gospel on a normal Sunday during any given year. And the results, of course, are painfully clear. As I travel around the country and visit churches, perhaps after an absence of 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, I discover things more or less exactly as they were. And when the announcements are given, the one thing in their favour at times is their brevity, and the one thing to their discredit is that they announce next Sunday there will be services as usual. And there is a sense in which that is tragic. There will be services as usual. If we take the aggregate of all of the churches where this is true, we have to admit, with the parody that has too much truth for comfort, like a mighty tortoise moves the church of God, brothers, we are treading where we've always trod. And in many cases, it seems to me that our evangelical churches, of all places, our evangelical churches have lost their nerve about the preaching of the gospel. Let me give you one or two indications of this. There is, first of all, what I called yesterday the big event syndrome. There's no real expectation. I don't sense an expectation in our churches that God is going to work. There's no real expectation of conversion other than in the tiniest of trickles until the next big event hits the country. And then we can anticipate that God will work. We may even come to believe the publicity of some of these events. I give these two examples in no way as a criticism of the event concern, but merely addressing the point of believing the publicity about the event. When I was preaching in Anchorage, Alaska, at the time of Billy Graham's visit to Sheffield, or immediately after it, someone came to me there in Alaska and said, I hear tremendous things are happening in England. I've been reading reports of the Billy Graham crusade at Sheffield, And I quote the man exactly to me, "The whole country must be on fire for God." And I said, "Well, I must have missed it. I flew out apparently just before the conflagration because I really didn't see it." At a follow-up to Mission England, someone said officially on behalf of Mission England in a public meeting that what happened in the West Country at Ashton Gate exceeded anything that happened in the days of Wesley and Whitfield. That was officially said on behalf of Mission England. Now, let's be very careful how we react to that. And my first reaction is, our God could do something in this day, in a moment, that would make everything that happened in the days of Wesley and Whitfield pale into insignificance. Our God is able. The question is, did it actually happen? And the other question is, how many people are actually believing the publicity and are therefore gearing themselves and gathering themselves for the next similar event of any such kind, because that is the way, the only way apparently, in which God is going to work in this country. Therefore, you have this vicious circle. There now must be another big event, because it is through the big events that God is now working as he did in the days of Wesley and Whitfield. And he's not doing it in our humdrum services as usual churches week after week. And the entrepreneurs of middle ground evangelicalism are endlessly enterprising in drawing attention to the next big event, and inevitably away from the life and work and potential of the local church. It all tends to make evangelism in this country a brief and brilliant fever followed by a long chill. Others have fallen for the siren sounds of entertainment evangelism. Under the relentless pressure of their members, and especially the younger element, and in capitulation to the avalanche of advertising, they've abandoned faith, naked faith in the preached word, and have turned to the perceivably more rewarding means of music and drama. And I believe that we have by no means yet paid the full price of our defection to showcase evangelism. I was invited to one of our leading universities, and I can certainly say that it was not the University of Liverpool, Errol, but there are others, to one of our leading universities, an impassioned letter from one of the leaders of the committee, pleading with me to come and preach at an evangelistic weekend, and saying there are now on our committee, in this vast university, only two Christians who have maintained a solid faith in the power of the preaching of the Word of God. And if you do not come, we will be bound to be swept overboard by what he called alternative evangelism. Why, he said, we've just had, as the evangelistic Christmas effort, a Christmas ball, a dance, was the evangelistic effort. And we had music and dancing and all sorts of exciting things happening. And a great crowd and many unconverted people came. And it is the view of the committee this was one of the greatest successes we've had. Will you come and preach? And if you will not come and preach, why they should have picked on me and put it in this way, I really don't know. If you will not come and preach, then I'm afraid it will be some other form of alternative evangelism that we will have to put on. Thirdly, some have turned aside to seek for signs to add power to their evangelism. A couple of weeks ago, I attended a conference of British evangelists. It was attended by about 250 or so people. I have to say that most of them were not evangelists in the sense that I understand it. They certainly weren't preaching evangelists. They were people involved in all kinds of peripheral activities connected with broadly based evangelism in our country today. There were musicians and mimers and artists and dramatists and all the rest of it, but at least it was a conference of British evangelists. And we were addressed by a self-styled prophet today who announced at the beginning of his message that he was going to instruct us how to preach the gospel today, and then said this: "If you will do what I am about to tell you to do, I will absolutely guarantee that the results of your evangelism will be increased by a factor of 5. Whatever the results you are getting, you can put multiply by 5, and I will guarantee that that will happen. And then what we were asked to do was to preach with words, deeds, and signs. And then we were regaled with a quite extraordinary Pandora's box of possibility, from the rectifying of dandruff to the raising of the dead. And we were told that if we did this, the results would be multiplied by 5. Now that is, you may say, astonishing and terrifying. Let me tell you something more terrifying. That man, having spoken for 1 hour and 20 minutes and answered questions for 20 minutes, was the only speaker in the whole conference given a thunderous ovation by today's evangelists in Britain. Well, we're not going to probe that issue, but I am reminded of Scripture saying that if a man will not believe Moses and the prophets, he will not believe even though one be raised from the dead. And the number of conversions resulting from the cure of dandruff has not yet been tabulated. There are some who would rejoice in the ability to get dandruff. Those who have beaches where the waves used to be. But let me get back to the title, Mobilizing the Church for Evangelism. And look at our words here. The word evangelism isn't mentioned in the New Testament. Not a very propitious beginning. And the word evangelist mentioned only 3 times. Firstly in Ephesians 4, one of the gifts of the ascended Christ to the church. Secondly in 2 Timothy 4, where Timothy, a pastor, is exhorted, quote, to do the work of an evangelist, although there's no article in the original, and that seems to indicate that the reference is not to an office, but to a function. Even in a settled, non-itinerant office, he is to be an evangelizing preacher. And within our modern structures, there are particular difficulties and discouragements, very obviously, in doing that. It's not easy to maintain a freshness and zeal in preaching the relatively narrow spectrum of the gospel message to the same, often small group, most of whom you already know to be saved. Then thirdly, in Acts 21, verse 8, there's mention of Philip the evangelist, one of the first deacons, but we also find him at work in Samaria and in the desert, and then at Azotus. And then, quote, he traveled about preaching the gospel in all the towns until he reached Caesarea. And maybe that is the clearest affinity we have to the understood function of a modern-day itinerant evangelist. Well, so much for evangelism. When we get to the word preaching, we seem to be on more fruitful ground. There are over 130 references to that in the New Testament. And that, of course, it includes formal preaching, that is, in a building within the structure of programmed worship, but by no means exclusively so. It's used of Jesus and John the Baptist and Peter and others in open-air preaching. It's the word used of Philip in his one-on-one encounter with the Ethiopian eunuch. It's used of the church at large, scattered by persecution from Jerusalem, as we read in Acts 8. So preaching, which when linked with the word gospel or evangelistic, becomes evangelism, is not limited to buildings and services and professional practitioners. Michael Green says, there is no hint among ancient records that the early church saw evangelism as the task of the leadership alone. And then adds this, it was too good to leave to the professionals. A.W. Pink will be turning in his grave, but that at least is Michael Green's comment. So obviously we are within biblical parameters when we speak of mobilizing the church for evangelism. I want to draw out some threads from the pattern of my own work and our work in Christian ministries missions. It used to be our pattern to go to a church, two of us, two or three of us, for 8 days of evangelism, but actually to begin on the Saturday and go through the Sunday week. And on the Saturday, we would have a gathering called Meet the Team. It would not be an evangelistic gathering, and that would be the title of it. And I'm sure that when the church members heard that phrase, they perceived it as being, they understood it as being an occasion for the church to come and meet the team. And the team was going to be the two or three men who would be with them for a week. But whenever I had the opportunity of speaking at that particular meeting, I would turn the whole thing around and say, now, we, here in the front, we two, or we three, we have come to meet the team. We are not the team. You are the team. We are just temporary additions to it. You are the team, and we have come to join you. The church is the entire body of believers, not just a small group of professionals with part-time help from Sunday school teachers and Bible class leaders and one or two others. And then I've been in the habit, when discussing an evangelistic mission with the church, perhaps at some point they would ask me, and if not, I would find ways of introducing it anyway, they might ask me now, do you have any ideas about the program for this particular evangelistic effort, about what we should do? And I sometimes went to the actual point of lifting up a piece of paper like this, with nothing at all on it, and saying, yes, there is the program so far. At which the brighter ones were able to say, but that's a blank sheet of paper. And I would say, yes, that's exactly what it is, and that is exactly what the program is at the moment. We are taking absolutely nothing for granted. We're not going to transgress the 11th and 12th commandments that I gave you again yesterday. Thou shalt not do it like this, because it's never been done like this before. Or thou shalt always do it like this, because it's always been done like this before. I said, we are coming with a blank sheet of paper. All our options are open. Within scriptural parameters, we can go anywhere, do anything at any time, in any fashion. And therefore we begin with a blank sheet of paper. And I go on to say something like this. I want you to imagine that there has never been an evangelistic mission in this church. Never. Nobody's ever thought of the idea before. And now you've had this burden and this vision, and we're about to have a week of evangelism. Now, let's write down on this blank sheet of paper what it is we've got to work with. We have this church. We have X number of members. We have these premises. We have 8 days. We have 24 hours a day. We have two evangelists. Now, that much we know. These are our resources. We're surrounded by these people working in these situations. This is the kind of context in which we're working. These are the kind of people we have in our church membership. How best can we employ the resources we have, the building we have, the membership we have, the surroundings we have, the people among whom we live and work? How can we best mix all of those things in together and reach people effectively with the gospel? And we start with a blank sheet of paper. We don't start by saying, well, of course, we'll have a service in the church every night at 7:30, won't we? One's response to that would almost always be, well, whatever else we might do, I think we're going to find out when we've thought the thing through. That is the last thing we will consider doing. If all else fails, we'll have a service. But everything else would have to fail first. And I think that there's a measure in which the same could be true in an ongoing context. So much energy is taken up in keeping the time-honored, and maybe time-worn is a better phrase, machinery going. The meetings and the societies and the auxiliaries and the committees, especially the committees, keeping them going. Surely there is a point at which we should stop and subject the whole thing to a thorough and radical examination. And be prepared to abandon or change anything and everything that is not realistically contributing to the effective spread of the gospel. Perhaps the first step in mobilizing any local church for evangelism is to dismantle what's already there. At the World Congress on Evangelism in Berlin in 1966, Walter Kunert said this: the only valid consideration for the church to realize at all times must be what serves the gospel, its credibility, its deepening, its propagation. What forms, customs, and ordinances must be removed, changed, or avoided, lest the church itself be a burden to faith in the gospel? There's a delightful story told about one of our very famous schools in this country that was to receive a distinguished overseas visitor. And he would, of course, be given a tour of the whole premises, And one of the members of staff was deputed to swat up all the history of the school and what this stained window was about and who that worthy over there was and what this painting represented and what this statue meant and all the rest of it. And he did his homework well, and the great day arrived and the limousine swept up the drive. The distinguished visitor came out, was introduced to his guide, and floored him with the very first question. He swept his hand over the whole of the scene before him and said, "Now tell me this. What is all this for?" And just for a moment, the member of staff had no idea. He could tell you when it was founded and who did this and who did that and who the first, second and third headmasters were and what that stained glass window went and what that, when that statue was put up and what this meant and what that meant. But as to what we're actually supposed to be doing here, for a moment, he couldn't remember. I heard of a vicar who said that the Church of England was becoming a society for the preservation of ancient buildings. And we find it easy to laugh at that here. The tragedy is that many of our churches are societies for the preservation of not so ancient buildings. There are two questions, surely, for a local church, or there are these two and many others. Firstly, is there any kind of reasonable viability between the amount of time and effort and money and energy being expended and the number of people being realistically reached with the gospel? And secondly, what is the disparity between the number being reached and those who are unreached but within reach? So I think it's right to examine everything. I mean everything. I mean everything ought to be examined. There's certainly biblical warrant for believers meeting together to worship the Lord on the Lord's Day. There's certainly no warrant of that kind for holding morning and evening services at the times that we have them, and which were certainly not chosen with man's modern customs and habits in mind. Nor, certainly, is there any warrant for instance, as in the case in many churches, of making the evening service the major evangelistic focus of the church's life. We have a member of conference here in whose church a colleague and I held a mission a little while ago. Very small church that had made, I think, great, very commendable efforts to reach people with the gospel. And certainly in preparing for that little mission, and I am speaking of a very small church, I think had probed a number of very interesting areas. I think I'd be right in saying, for instance, that they may have had about three teachers attached to the church, school teachers, who had no idea how they would get those school teachers into the church to hear a gospel message preached in the context of a service on a weeknight. And they're right, I'm sure they wouldn't have gotten it. So they hit on this idea. They said, "We'll meet in the pub." So we went along to the local hostelry. They made arrangements. They did sanctify it. We met in an upper room. And we met in an upper function room in the local pub. And they had, we can say, a large number of teachers who came to that function. They laid on a wonderful array of food, snacks to be eaten informally. I remember when the leader of the meeting called the attention of the group together and said, "Now we're just going to go over here and have some sandwiches and coffee and so forth, and then when we've had that we'll gather together more formally." And the first teacher to come along said, "Oh, is this the food? Well, I thought at least we'd have loaves and fishes." Most interesting. And the teachers all sat down, and when we'd eaten that, I spoke straightforwardly, as clearly as I possibly could. There was a man in the front, I swear, that he was going to blow a gasket. He got so infuriated after 2 or 3 minutes, he kept turning around and making constant running commentary on what I was saying to the person behind him. And as soon as I asked the questions, I was overwhelmed. I mean, he just tore into me. Now, you give me a night in a pub with a group of unconverted teachers, and I would sooner preach there than in the biggest church in this country with a few unconverted people scattered here and there and the usual evangelical liturgy before someone gets up to preach. I don't think there's any comparison. Now, the pastor of that particular church worked tremendously hard in that mission. We contacted a relatively large number of unconverted people, and quite a number gave us what sounded like a promise that they would be there on the final Sunday of the mission. And I can tell you that I nearly ran to the church for the Sunday to think of all of these people that we'd contacted, and they were going to be there, and one was now going to get a chance to preach perhaps more fully to them in the context of whatever we would arrange for the church service. There was virtually no one there. I think I'm right in saying not one. We'd come across that situation before, and in discussing it with the pastor, he said something like this, and he's here and is of age and can speak for himself and correct me later. But essentially what I heard him saying was this: well, I don't think that Sunday is the day for evangelism anyway. And I'm not even sure that we ought to be investing that amount of time and effort in our services in preaching the gospel. I think that Sunday ought to be for the Christians and the gospel ought to be preached during the rest of the week by the membership. Now, that sounds radical and borders on the heretical, even if we make allowances for the fact that he's Irish. But is he saying nothing that's of any value? Are we going to dismiss that and say, well, of course, the fellow's lost his marbles? We preach the gospel in our church on Sunday, and if the lost don't come in, that's a pity. They are guilty before God. There's the church. They can see it. The texts are outside. Why don't they come in? We are as guilty of not going out as they are guilty of not coming in. Are our familiar structures holy writ? Or are they, after all, just the traditions of men? Are they the best that we can do? Or are they just those things with which we are comfortable? Let me fantasize for a moment. Here's a church with 100 in attendance. Other than families and adherents, there are perhaps 5 unconverted people there. So it's obviously a good Sunday. But that church expects its paid pastor to spend, I'm now assuming a Sunday morning, a Sunday night, and a midweek service. That church expects its paid pastor to spend 1/3 of his studying time, 1/3 of his thinking time, and 1/3 of his preaching time speaking to those 5 people. Now let me put another slide, as it were, on the screen. Here's the same church, and on that Sunday night, 20 of its best members are absent. They're not on holiday, they're at home. They're sitting at home with friends. And each of those groups, let's call them 10 sets of husbands and wives, have invited 4 neighbours in for the evening. They've got an evening meal with them, and when the meal is over, they just sit down and chat. And in the course of that conversation, they bring the issue around to the gospel of the Lord Jesus. And they share the gospel with them. Now, we have 40 unconverted people being reached. Of course, we have a smaller congregation, but we do have 40 unconverted being reached. Which is the more important? Meanwhile, back at the church, the evening program is geared to teaching rather than to worship with preaching tacked on at the end, even if it's a rather long tack. Instead of a straightforward preaching situation as we envisage it, it's not so much a time of public worship, it's a time of private instruction. There may be some feedback to all of this. There may be a sharing of some problems. There may be a time of corporate prayer. And having gone this far down the road of outright heresy, let me go one terrible step further. Perhaps that could take the place of the midweek meeting, which is usually attended only by a small fraction of the faithful. Anyway, maybe we could abandon that, and maybe that would result in a better standard of preaching. At least it would be a small step away from a situation where many of our members have so many meetings, they don't have any time left to be Christians. Or at least they have very little time left to befriend in depth those who need the gospel and who live next door to them. There is something mildly absurd about our Christian members believing that their non-Christian neighbors are lost, but they're forced to abandon them to their lostness in order to go along to meet with more people who are already saved. There's something faintly absurd about that. that many of our members, with a great sense of loyalty to the local church, that the church has become so programmed, it's so busy, there are so many meetings to attend, and when it's not public meetings, then of course it's groups within that, and there's this group and that group and this committee and this subcommittee, and they must attend all of these things, and they must leave their neighbours perishing and untouched and unreached because they have this loyalty to attend all the functions of the local Christian group. That's the fantasy. Now you try turning that into fact. Why, it's 20 years ago now, I was conducting a crusade on a housing estate in Leeds. The church for, I think, a couple of years had been using the Challenge Christian newspaper. Religiously, that's a good word, religiously on that estate. They'd gone out and they'd visited every home and they'd delivered it month after month after month. And then after a while it said to people, now we will only come back and deliver it if you are willing to pay for it. It's only a matter of pence, but there was a principle involved. They thought they would read it if they paid for it. Well, of course, that reduced the visitation list, but there were still a number of houses, quite a surprising number, who said they would like to receive it. And month after month, the church visitors went and had a word on the doorstep with these people, gave them their copy of Challenge, and they paid for it and so forth. As the mission was approaching, I made this suggestion. Instead of holding a service on Sunday morning, why don't we just scrap it? And on the first Sunday of the mission, let us select 10 homes into which a team of, say, 3 people who have been involved in the Challenge distribution could go. They would jog them along about this for some months beforehand, if necessary. And say, now, what we want to do on that particular Sunday, we don't just want to stay on the doorstep and pass some comments about the weather and then hand you your newspaper. On that particular occasion, there'll be 3 of us instead of the usual 2 or whatever, and we'd just like to come into your house, and we will be with you for 30 minutes. We absolutely promise that unless you want to detain us longer, that's as long as we'll take. We'll just come into your home. We'd like to sit down with you. We'd like to pray for your family. We'd like to hear something, more about the family than we know, and we just want to share in just a little more depth what is being said in this paper month after month. Well, for some exhilarating moments, I really thought the church was going to grasp that. I thought I was going to achieve my ambition to have a morning service cancelled. And instead, those who weren't out on the teams could meet to pray for those who were. And then these teams would go out, and in 10 homes on that estate, maybe reaching 30, 40, 50, 60 people on that estate that morning, the gospel would actually be communicated at a level that people would appreciate and understand in the comfort of their own home, not in uncomfortable pews, not surrounded by our evangelical liturgies that we love so much and other people find incomprehensible. But the gospel would be shared with these people, and just for some moments I thought it was going to be achieved. But alas, the vote went against it, and we all met in church on Sunday morning, and all the lost sat in their homes on Sunday morning, and we held an evangelistic mission. Let me give you something a little less drastic. I was speaking to a small group of pastors in a very small South Wales town some years ago, and after speaking on some aspects of evangelism, opened it for questions, and the pastor, as it happened, I think, of the very church in that town, a room, it seems to me, about half this size, and with the freestanding chairs there, obviously a multi-purpose building, and he said, well, how can we reach our neighbours in this little town with the gospel from this church? What would you suggest we do, for instance, about Sunday evening service? I said, I'd scrap it. Well, after we'd applied the sal volatile, he said, you'd scrap it? I said, yes, I wouldn't hold one. Well, what would you do instead? I said, well, let me make a suggestion. I'd meet for tea instead. That's a much better idea. I'd just meet to have tea. Well, how would you do it? I said, well, you've got nice chairs here and little tables I can see stacked around somewhere. I'd put those around and I'd have the church members make some tea, some sandwiches and bits and pieces. And then I would have invited your neighbours to this open tea. We're going to have tea for the village or the little town in the chapel on Sunday night. Don't have it at 6:30. That's just before the best television programmes come on. Don't be unsympathetic about it. Have it earlier. Have it at 5:30. So that you're not interfering with their television. And have it at 5:30. But it's so nice, everybody's got to eat. They've got to eat somewhere. Now they can eat in the chapel and they don't have to pay for it. Don't have to buy the food. So you get your neighbours along and you sit around with them and have a good time. And when it's all over, the minister may stand up and say how nice it was to see the guests here. And much appreciate the folk who've made the tea. And if he's got half his wits about him, he can extend that vote of thanks into 15 minutes in which he communicates the gospel to the people who are there. They don't even know they're being preached at. Well, pastor looked at me and said, that sounds... I said, let me see. The worst thing that could happen would be that nobody would show up. That's the worst thing. None of the lost would come. I said, you know where that would put you? Exactly where you are now. Now, that's the worst. So the worst scenario is you'll be exactly as you are. That's the worst. And he looked at me and said, well, he said, can you imagine me selling that with success to a bunch of Welsh deacons? He didn't use the word bunch, but I've been in America too often, Jeff. Whatever the collective noun for Welsh deacons is, I can think of several, but... but this is being recorded. Can you imagine me communicating that successfully to a gathering of Welsh deacons? I said, no, sir, but I'm not asking just to communicate it to you. Well, let me be even gentler. I was in a church on one occasion preparing for a mission, and I suggested... that on a Sunday night they ought to try doing this. That the Sunday night service, which they might call a guest service or whatever, would consist of a hymn and a prayer and a 30-minute evangelistic message, and everybody adjourns to the church hall and they sit around and drink coffee and chat about what's gone on. And 6 weeks later the pastor phoned me and said, we did it. Would you believe it worked? People came. And it seemed to go well. And our people joined in and they communicated afterwards in the church hall. So all you've got is a hymn. Let's worship God together. I'm not ashamed to do that in the presence of the heathen. Let's worship God together. And then let's pray for God to help us now as we open his word. And then let's preach from the word and stop. And then go into the church hall and meet with people. We don't have to leave off being human just because we've become Christians. Well, if that's too big a step to consider, and surely it's a small step, if it is too big a step even to consider, then I think we're being stubborn and stupid under the guise of being spiritual. That surely is no more than the refining of a guest service. You may have guest services, whether you go the whole hog or not, then let me urge you to gear a guest service to the guests. Don't even give 5 minutes to the insiders. What do the outsiders really make of our favourite choruses or hymns? Every member ought to feel a part of the outreach team, and the preacher ought to preach as if there's not one Christian in the building. Back to our Christian ministry strategy on missions. Let me just pick up one or two more threads, which could be woven, it seems to me, into the ongoing church life. We have a slogan, if you will, a desire that when we go to a church, we leave behind not a church that has been evangelized, but a church that is evangelistic. And the same person who made those eccentric comments about the Lord's Day earlier was saying to me yesterday that he has had some departures from his church since the mission because they could not stand the new vision and determination of members of that church that we are not just here to worship Sunday by Sunday and hope that somehow the lost will come in, but that we have to get out where they are and do something. And he actually had church adherents, whether precisely they were members or not is perhaps not important at this point, who felt they really couldn't be comfortable in that situation. In general, we have moved away from the preaching service or the preaching rally. And one of the reasons is that there's not an evangelist in Britain who holds the slightest attraction for any of the lost. But we have not moved away from preaching. Our main thrust could be described as hospitality evangelism, and the key word, as I mentioned yesterday, is food. And we do believe that there's biblical warrant for that. More warrant for preaching the gospel over food than over four hymns and the announcements. We have the example of Levi, we have the church moving from house to house, we have the command to practice hospitality, and so forth. Let me try to run through very quickly some of the things that we've done. Remember, this is in the context of a mission, but I'll try to make some application. We've held a great number of formal or informal, informal buffet style, that is, central meals on church premises. These have been strictly on a one-for-one basis. For example, if you wanted to hold a men's dinner, we have said, well, how many men do you think would come to a men's dinner in your church on Monday night in the church hall? And if it's a smallish church, and they might say, well, we would have 15 men who might come to that, then we would say, then let's cater for 30 men, but only 15 of your men can come. And the only way that one of your members can get inside that building and partake of that meal is if he brings an unconverted person with him. Now, that immediately guarantees that 50% at least of those who are hearing the gospel at the end of that meal, 50% at least are unconverted. We've had men rising to the occasion saying, well, I can bring three. I can't think of one of them who'd come to a service in the church. I can think of three of my colleagues at work who would come to a dinner and to hear a speaker afterwards. That's fine. And all we do is have the meal and the message. There is nothing else. Nothing. You can have a meal for men or for couples or for friends and neighbours or for work colleagues. There's an endless variety of permutations there. Sometimes we've held a meal in a local restaurant. That can be particularly attractive and suitable for some and in some areas. Just taken over the restaurant for the night. Open house is something that we've done with a mixture, sometimes of great success and otherwise of quite disappointing failure, where you just have the church hall on a very informal basis. It's not a set meal. You don't take out the three-line whip on one must bring one or he doesn't get in, and that maybe is when it's been a failure. And people just come in and sit around and talk and snack for 40 minutes, and at the end of that, their attention is gathered, and the evangelist gets up and speaks. There's no program. He simply preaches the gospel at that point. We major in our missions, and have done for a long time, on house meetings, not house churches. I'm not talking about the house church, but we must beware, as Vance Havner has said in a totally different connection, we must be aware of being so afraid of going out on a limb that we never get up the tree. And we mustn't get so frightened of Christians meeting in homes that we are scared to allow them to meet in homes. Let me give you some of the advantages of people meeting in their homes. Firstly, the setting is more natural. We have perhaps not fully grasped how foreign and frightening the most attractive of our church buildings can become to the unconverted. It is a terrifying prospect. And if you don't think it's frightening, you watch an unconverted husband and wife coming to church, and I'll guarantee you the husband is trailing along behind. He is terrified. Terrified. Secondly, house meetings can be held at any time of day. Thirdly, the length of the gathering is often not a pressure point. Fourthly, the people attending it are probably neighbours, so there are no travel problems involved. Fifthly, there can be group participation and discussion, the New Testament dialogismos, and it helps to avoid, incidentally, spending all of our time answering questions that nobody's asking. Sixthly, church members must get involved. They must get involved. If they don't get involved, there's no meeting. The trouble with our present structures is there are meetings, but nobody's getting involved. Now, this means they must get involved, because if they don't get involved, there's no meeting. There is no meeting. Seventhly, it clarifies the Christian witness to neighbours. The neighbours now find out what it is that the Christian friends really believe. And eighthly, it may help to prise open those forbidding church doors. Let me give you some possibilities for evangelistic house meetings. Firstly, you can have a coffee morning, or afternoon, or evening, or just about any time in between. There's no programme needed. Secondly, you could have a snack lunch for neighbours. That's been very effective. I've seen this held in a little cul-de-sac. And a neighbour from just about every house in that cul-de-sac was there for a snack lunch. They got to eat at some time. And you have a snack lunch and someone is there and spends the 30 minutes after lunch sharing the gospel with these people. Thirdly, you could have a formal dinner in a home. That's perfectly proper in some places and among some people. That's the kind of thing that they fit into. I've seen that done with great effect. You can have an informal supper. The danger with that is that if you're not careful, the eating and the chat will crowd the gospel out. Fifthly, you could have an evangelistic Bible study, or even an evangelistic Bible study series. It could be based on an evangelistic book. This would need to be worked out pretty carefully beforehand and with seriously minded people. But I've seen it done. I've seen it done with very great effect. The people have taken a book, and once they've gathered their people together, they said, now, here's a copy of this book, and we want you to go away. We're going to meet for the next six Thursdays, or whatever. And all you've got to do is to go away and read one chapter of that book and come and tell us what you think about it. And to help you to decide what you think about it, here are three questions that we'd particularly like to have your thoughts channeled along. And they come back the next week and discuss them. And at the end of 6 or 7 weeks, they've worked their way through. an evangelistic book. You could have a video evening. Video is very much the in thing these days. Someone told me as I came to this meeting that they're using some of the videos we have in Christian ministries. They're just 10-minute evangelistic thought prompters, if you like. They're available free of charge. They can be just borrowed from Christian ministries and used in the home. Excuse me galloping at this point, but the clock is doing the same. Evangelistic literature. In our CM missions, we've made unusual use of evangelistic literature, and we can testify to its effectiveness. Many of you are familiar, I'm sure, with the quotation from Samuel Zwemer, the great missionary to the Muslims. No other agency can penetrate so deeply, witness so daringly, abide so persistently, and influence so irresistibly as the printed page. And much more recently, David Watson, himself so brilliant in some areas of evangelism. The most effective political and religious movements have always known the power of the printed page. What men think is largely determined by what they read. Now, there's a vast area there, and you would have to sit down in your own local situation and try to think of ways of penetrating with evangelistic literature. Is there no way into the local press? Have you explored that? Is there absolutely no way in which you could not contribute 100 words once a week in a column in the Christian press that would address some local issue, bring a Christian slant to it, infiltrate the gospel into the mass media in that way? Are you convinced there is no way in which that can be done? What about these free papers? I get 5 every week. 5 free papers come clattering through my door. It's difficult to study sometimes with the clatter of the next free newspaper coming in. Now, is there absolutely no way in which in these papers, which have to fill their pages and columns week after week, there is absolutely no way in which we can get into this? Challenge, the good newspaper is still available. Is it totally out of date? Do we rule it out? Have we thrown it overboard? Do we say it's no good? Is it totally non-effective? Have we proved that? Some churches give an evangelistic book or booklet to every known visitor who comes to the church. I know one man who took upon himself the personal responsibility of placing 5,000 copies of an evangelistic book, one into every home in his town, and he never dropped one through the letterbox. He actually met the person on the doorstep and gave them a copy of that book. What about doctors and dentists, waiting rooms and other waiting rooms, and libraries and institutions that surround many of our churches? Is there absolutely nothing whatever that we can do to introduce any evangelistic literature of any kind into those situations? At the risk of sounding like an oblique commercial, I still receive letters from people converted through reading Right with God and from many different countries. And that book was first published in 1972. A gentleman told me yesterday in this conference that the very first 3 people that he gave it to, and they came from 3 different nationalities, were all converted through reading that particular book. Where is John Rubens? Well, Bill Clark is here. I really must be careful now and not anticipate too much. It will be sufficient to say that some of us are working and thinking at the moment of producing something that we... the aim of which, as far as we're concerned, is to produce remarkably inexpensively a most attractive, and we believe, and you won't misunderstand me, within the orbit of 32 pages, a thorough, a biblical presentation of the gospel that we believe those of you represented at this conference would not be ashamed to use, would be willing to use, and we hope can be made available for you to use in such a way that there may not be one single church represented here that could not use hundreds, and some that could use thousands in the course of a year in their evangelistic work. And if John would want to say something more about that before the end of the conference, I must leave that to him. The church that spends thousands on getting a better organ or piano and 100 or so on literature in the course of a year has surely got its vision and priorities distorted. I would suggest to you that by and large we are stingy and small-minded and short-sighted in the very area where we ought to be generous, enterprising, adventurous, and even prodigal. No farmer goes around sowing one seed at a time and then hoping that that one seed will produce something. He broadcasts it, scatters it abroad, prodigally, in the belief that here and there and there and there and there, there's going to be a harvest. We've moved a very long way. We can get back to Spurgeon again. We quoted him yesterday, who reckoned that he had 56,000 extra hearers every time he preached because they read his sermons each week. You know the story of one man who gave away 250,000 and of a wealthy Russian who distributed 1 million. Sermon Spurgeon on baptismal regeneration was given away in its hundreds of thousands. Or Hannah Moore, subsidized by Henry Thornton, who distributed tracts every month and in the first year had distributed 2 million. It was an expansion of that work which led in part to the formation of the Religious Tract Society, and it was at a meeting of the Religious Tract Society that Thomas Charles told the story of Mary Jones and her Bible, which eventually led to the formation of the British and Foreign Bible Society. We'd forgotten that Hudson Taylor was converted to reading a tract. And we could give other marvelous instances of what has happened through Christian literature. I really do believe that we have missed out in this area. We have become very stingy and small-minded, and we give out a little bit here, and a little bit there, and a little bit there. The communists don't do that. They don't pick out a single person here and a single person there. Brethren, I say it again, we should be prodigious in the amount of evangelistic literature that we distribute among the masses of people around us. And that brings me back full circle into Acts 8 and verse 4. Those who had been scattered abroad preached the word wherever they went. And at the end of the day, the key element in the witness of the local church must be the personal witness of its members. And there's no clearer example of that, surely, than of Jesus himself and the amount of attention he gave to individuals, a fisherman, a civil servant, a prostitute, a housewife, a religious leader, and so on. So in Acts 8, of the church in general, and without a torrent of techniques, Richard Halverson has said, evangelism never seemed to be an issue in the New Testament. That is to say, one does not find the apostles urging, exhorting, scolding, planning, organizing for evangelistic programs. Evangelism happened. And the key to recapturing the genius of personal evangelism is certainly not more conferences and another soul-winning system and a handbook of techniques. It is surely motivation. Our people must be moved, not manipulated. To quote David Watson again, if Christians lack the desire to evangelize, then our conferences and courses and strategies and schemes and missions and crusades will all be utterly in vain. And the pastor's part in all of that, of course, and you know it well, is in Ephesians 4, where the reason given for your existence is to prepare God's people for works of service. And I believe that that is best done by repeatedly majoring on the major soteriological themes. My time has more than gone, but let me just at least suggest that this. They're found in 2 Corinthians 5, where you can read what motivated Paul. Possible to identify six there. I'll close by mentioning three, which are the clearest and the most of the four. The first, in verse 10, is the reality of divine judgment. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. We all, and the lost will have no protection from the eternal wrath of God. The lostness of the lost. And that is relevant to our service. James Denny has said, let us familiarize ourselves with the fear due to Christ, the judge, and a new power will enter into our service, making it at once more urgent and more wholesome than it could otherwise be. The second motivation is Christ's death for sinners, verses 20 and 21. And of course, there's a sense in which the whole message is there in verse 21, and in which there is all the motive that we could ever possibly need. God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. And the third motivation, the love of Christ. Verse 14, the love of Christ compels us. John Owen says, we are never nearer Christ than when we find ourselves lost in amazement at his unsurpassable love. My brothers, if the church is to be mobilized, it must be motivated. There is no greater motivation than the gospel itself, and there is no greater element in the gospel than the dying love of Christ for sinners. And if that will not move us and motivate us and mobilize us, then nothing will.
and nothing can.